Ann Ruffey had been married for 39 years when, in December 2005, her husband Herman died abruptly of a heart attack. Although Ms. Ruffey had been a prominent writer and feminist thinker for decades, she found herself unprepared to take over the simple things her husband had always done for her, like hailing a cab and even unlocking her apartment door. And she writes about dealing with the grief of his loss and about the difficulties of putting her life back together in a new memoir. She's called Epilogue. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm pleased that it has brought her back to the show today. Hello.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Would it be accurate to describe you and your husband, Herman, as having been soulmates?
It would be absolutely accurate. We were soulmates. We were companions. We were friends. We were sexual partners. We had a not perfect marriage, because I don't even believe in such a thing, but we had a good marriage.
There are any number of writers, women, who were married to psychotherapists, psychoanalysts. Is there some kind of a connection that I should have known about earlier in my life?
If only that were so. If only it were so simple. Yes, his being a psychoanalyst played a part in our lives, but I don't think that psychoanalysts are perfect mates or perfect people. They're just kind of fun to be with.
As I said, he died suddenly of a heart attack in the lobby of your apartment building.
Yes.
Would you have been better able to cope with his death, you think, if there had been more of a warning?
Well, of course, you never know about the door that didn't open. I was, of course, totally shocked and numbed by the event.
Was he in good health? He was 81 years old.
He was in perfect health. He had seen patients. We had gone to a concert. We'd gone out to dinner with friends. So that in some sense, it was a surprise. On the other hand, he was 81 years old and 12 years older than I am. The other part of it is that I was instantly and remain grateful that he had that kind of death. When you love somebody, you want them to have a death that is quick and unforeseen and let them have their life up to the end as fully as possible. And he did have that.
You say that you realized after he died that you'd always overestimated your own independence. Would he have said something similar if you'd been the first to die?
I'm not so sure. I don't know. You know, men have a kind of autonomy. And I am, after all, I am a feminist. I am a modern woman. I'm a working woman. I have working women daughters. But I was raised in the 40s and I was raised in the 50s. And there are certain things that are hard for me. The idea that I would be standing next to a man and that I would take the car keys and I would drive is very hard for me. Those are habits of another time, and they have influenced the different ways in which we were autonomous.
Were you shocked? Were other people shocked by your the fact that you hadn't never opened the door?
Well, I don't know that they knew until I wrote it down in a book, but they do know now. And are they shocked? I would think that most people in my generation would understand this absolutely. Would my daughters understand it? Possibly not. But that's the wonderful thing about progress.
Your descriptions of the anxiety and the insomnia that you suffered in the weeks after your husband's death are really moving. Are they still a problem, or did the anxiety and sleeplessness dissipate over time?
It did dissipate. I fought it. I fought it to the ground. I finally fought it by not taking any kind of sleeping medication and just staying up for days till I was so exhausted I slept. I think the high level of anxiety that came right after Herman's death was bound to ebb. I'm not living in that state of anxiousness. When I'm out, I don't want to go home. When I'm home, I don't necessarily think I must be out. All kinds of anxious symptoms have subsided. On the other hand, there is still a part of me that is grieving. That does not go away.
And you write that the adage, time is the widow's friend, isn't necessarily true.
I think that says it as accurately as I know how.
By now, you must be used to comparisons between your book and Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. I'm sure you read that book.
Of course I did.
Do you see the differences in the way that you and Ms. Didion responded to the sudden deaths of your beloved spouses?
Well, first, let me say that Joan Didion is the most brilliant writer whom I admire almost more than any other living American writer. She is quite fantastic. However, we are completely different people. Therefore, the experience that we did have in common ran through our lives in different ways. I was more interested in, when I was writing this book, on what was going to come next, on planning, on showing to myself and to my reader what the experience was like moving forward. That's not quite what the Didion focus was.
Is it safe to assume that writing this memoir helped you cope with the pain that you were experiencing?
Of course it did. I'm a writer, and writing helps me cope with life and has since I started to write.
It also gives structure to your day.
It gave me something to do. If I would have just been sitting there, you know, thinking, what should I do today, that would have been harder. This way, I had a purpose, I had a focus, I had something I needed to do. Also, as I say in the book, writing changes what happens to you. So the way an anthropologist goes to a country and then just being there changes what happens in the country, writing probably changed what was happening to me day by day.
My guess is Anne Ruffey, author of 15 books. This is the 16th, I guess.
No, I think it's the 15th, but I haven't counted accurately.
This one is a memoir called Epilogue, and it's published by Harper. You've chosen not to identify the people that you've included in the book by name, and not just the people who we wouldn't know, but Herman is H, your daughters are K and B. We know who they are. Why did you do that?
In some way, I felt it gave me a distance. It made me able to write about them with more ease than if I had actually named them. The other characters...
I thought Kay was Kafka.
Well, the other characters and the people that I write about, men that I meet, whose names I give initials to, I did to protect their privacy.
And they should have that protection in some cases.
Yes, I think so.
You began dating after your daughter's placed the singles ad for you in the New York Review of Books. How long after Herman's death did they place that ad?
Oh, it must have been about 8 or 9 months. I don't remember exactly. It certainly wasn't immediately. It also wasn't last week.
And did you know they planned to do that?
Well, we talked about it, and I wasn't sure what they were going to do, and I didn't want to know, and I never looked at the ad, and I would have been embarrassed had I seen it. On the other hand, I was ready for something in life to change.
You tell a funny story about the first date that resulted from that ad with a man you've identified as PJ. You seem to be enjoying each other's company for a while, but can you tell us what happened?
Well, suddenly I felt him right on top of me at the table. We were in a restaurant. Then I felt his hand on my leg. Then I felt him stroking my arm like, you know, it was a horse's nose. And pretty soon his hands were all over me and we were in a public place. And then we stood up and he grabbed me in front of all the other tables and, you know, kissed me hard and felt me all over. And he said, was that good for you? And I realized the only proper response to that was to laugh.
He was trying to move things right along.
Well, he did say to me that the dating scene had changed since I was a young girl and that this was the way people behaved in the modern world. Now, I'm sure the dating scene has changed. In fact, my daughters tell me there is no dating scene.
Now you're telling me I'm newly single. There's no dating scene?
Well, not in a sense, not in the 50s sense of, I suspect, of the male coming to the door with a flower in hand and picking up the girl. That probably has changed. But what hasn't changed is our need to know each other before we're physically intimate, to respect each other's space in some way. That, I'm sure, is exactly the same.
One thing that has changed is that the internet has become such an important part of all of this. And you did go to Match.com.
Yes, I did.
Are there many people in your age bracket looking to meet each other on the internet?
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't done an accurate count. You know, you have to ask somebody from an internet service. But certainly, there were many men who contacted me, some of whom I responded to and some of whom I didn't. It's a fascinating kind of adventure because you can learn about people without risking anything. And you hear people's stories, which are wonderful to hear. You hear about other people's lives in other places and what those lives are like. And, you know, I'm just delighted there is such a thing as Match.com.
Well, it sounds like a writer's dream, but not necessarily the dream for somebody who is looking to establish a new relationship.
Well, I imagine people do. I haven't, but I don't know that it's impossible. I would think that people are people will find each other this way. After all, we live in a society which has so few ways for people of the same, of relatively the same age group, to meet each other.
You tell a story of having a pleasant time walking around the Botanic Gardens with a Brooklyn man you met online, but then you were put off by a confession he made at the end of your date. He admitted that he had no choice but to be untruthful online.
Well, he said that they hadn't asked him. They didn't put in their numbers of when you were born, years you were born, the year that he was born, because it was before the numbers started. And when I did the math, I realized he must be an extremely well-preserved, very, very, very elderly gentleman and a very nice person. But that was not what I was really wanting.
And then other people, I'm sure, are nice on some level. You can connect on some levels. But you talk about a man who you actually saw more than once corresponded with whose politics were just totally different from yours. That's something you ultimately couldn't get past?
Well, ultimately, his politics, which were extremely right-wing and had a lot to do with guns, came clear to me that they were politics of paranoia. And that kind of paranoia does not make for a loving man or a loving relationship. So it wasn't really so much the politics. I loved arguing with him, but that's because I enjoy that kind of debate.
Now, part of the problem isn't just finding somebody you're compatible with. It affects when something like this happens, it affects relations with people you've been friends with over the years, especially as part of a couple.
Yes. When you are single, there are different reverberations out in the social world. It isn't quite the same as it was. Not that, you know, I am not saying that, you know, couple friends turned their backs on me or that I was abandoned or anything of the sort. It's just that there's something different about being the only single person in a room.
There are also people who have a hard time going to hospitals or dealing with somebody who is going through a period of grief, and they are discomforted by spending time with them. They're afraid you're going to complain all the time.
I think, you know, the natural instinct is to look away from the car accident. And certainly, in fairness to those people who did not come close to me when I might have needed them, I might have been a car accident.
In her New York Times review, is it Maggie Scarf?
Yes.
She called your book a moving, immeasurably sad story of the aftermath of an irreplaceable relationship. Do you think that's a reason that it has been hard for you to find somebody?
Because the relationship was irreplaceable. Well,
people always assume that if they did it once, then they could do it again.
Well, my husband, the psychoanalyst, told me that it would be a sign of the goodness of our marriage if I was able to love someone else. And I do believe that that is so. And I don't believe that people are irreplaceable in that they are. One doesn't try to replace them. Can you, in fact, find another different relationship that will fill this particular space, time, moment, connection between the two of you? I'm sure that's so.
But so you haven't given up, even though it hasn't happened yet?
Not only, I mean, I haven't given it up, but I also have come to the conclusion that it's very important to live my life for myself as it is.
Well, a lot of people find themselves set in their ways at a certain point, and unless something incredible comes along, they think about the aggravation factor.
Well, I'm not thinking about an aggravation factor. I think most other people are interesting, and I'm ready to enjoy them, not to be aggravated by them.
Anne Ruffey will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night, is it?
Yes, it is.
At 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. And a listener, Eve, writes in, "I'm so sorry to hear that happened to you on a date, but it sounds as if you knew how to handle yourself. Good for you. Hang in there."
Thank you.
I don't know if you needed a cheerleader, but there's somebody out there. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, talking about this book, which I found a lot of, I hate to say it, a lot of fun to read. Epilogue, a memoir published by Harper, Anne Ruffey's 15th book.